Good morning. I'm going to start on time. How about that? I know. I learned it yesterday. SI has its own time. And we all run on it. And so I might as well go by the clock. It's as good as any other time. This poem is called Living in the Body by Joyce Sutphen. Body is something you need in order to stay on this planet, and you only get one. And no matter which one you get, it will not be satisfactory. It will not be beautiful enough. It will not be fast enough. It will not keep on for days at a time, but will pull you down into a sleepy swamp and demand apples and coffee and chocolate cake. Body is a thing that you eventually have to leave. You know that because you've seen others do it. Others who were once like you, living inside their pile of bones and flesh, smiling at you, loving you, leaning in the doorway, talking to you for hours, and then one day they're gone. No forwarding address. Several years ago at Thanksgiving, my brother-in-law Ted, who's a biologist studying actually the DNA of ants, the evolution of DNA, gave an eloquent statement when we went around the table and shared what we were grateful for about the scientific odds against his being alive, having met my sister, having produced this child, just really laid out the scientific odds of that in a very poetic way that I wish I had recorded. But it reminded me of this Tibetan Buddhist image. If the world was covered by one vast sea, and if one little inner tube was floating on that sea, and if a blind sea turtle somewhere in that sea surfaced to take a breath, what's the chance that that turtle would stick its nose up in the hollow of that inner tube? And yet here we all are. King Midas, the story tells us, wished that everything he touched would turn to gold because he thought gold was the most precious thing on earth. And he got that wish overnight. The next day he was thrilled when he touched his plate and it turned to gold, and he touched his goblet and it turned to gold, and things were going really well until he reached out to touch his breakfast and it turned inevitable. But then his darling daughter came dancing, twirling into the room, and before he could stop her, came and gave him a kiss on the cheek, immediately turning into a very valuable gold statue. And King Midas went mad with remorse. He realized at that point that the most precious thing on earth is not gold. It's human flesh inhabited by spirit. And no amount of gold can buy that back. What do we do with understanding the preciousness of flesh, of life? Forest Church, a minister at All Souls in New York City, says that religion is the response to the dual reality that we're alive now and we will die. I think the continuum that I laid out yesterday, the five ways to understand the relationship of faith and culture, can be helpful as we think about the relationship of faith and the body as well. So I'm going to use those again, just kind of as a framework to talk today. One way of thinking is that faith is against the body. The body is against faith. They're in opposition. When I was in college, a good friend of mine used to go to dinner on Sundays, free dinner, with the Hare Krishnas. She and Steve Jobs, with whom I also went to college and unfortunately did not become close friends. never write someone off as a geeky nerd. That's the lesson there. Anyway, one of the things that the Krishnas love to say is, this body is a gross lump of ignorance. And so we took great delight in calling each other gross lumps of ignorance. In key moments, faith, which is against the body, often posits that there's an afterlife in which it's much better because we don't have to have these horrible things, these bodies. And while my friend and I had a lot of fun calling each other gross lumps of ignorance, I want to remind us that the stakes with these theologies are a lot higher than what we might call our friends. I have a video that I wanted to show that's we're all familiar with this stuff, but it's kind of how the faith is against the body plays out a lot in our culture right now. This is my own Minnesota favorite, Michelle Bachmann, starts this off, but it's a...
And a gay couple who adopt children, in your mind, be considered a family?
When it comes to marriage and family, my opinion is that marriage is between a man and a woman.
Could Michelle Bachmann really win the Republican nomination for president next year?
In our poll, Unscientific, Bachmann beat Palin.
This week's survey, she won the support of 24%, 9 points better than anybody else in a crowded field.
Our ranks are big and they're growing.
Tea Party powerhouse Michelle Bachmann has rocketed to the top of the Republican pack. Tonight, a closer look at the business she and her husband own back home in Minnesota. An outside group filmed undercover video inside the Bachmann's Christian Counseling Center.
It's unambiguous. The goal was to change me from homosexual to heterosexual.
Praying away the gay is wicked hot.
Are you praying the gay away?
This is your wake-up call. Repent or perish.
I tried to pass the constitutional amendment in Minnesota to define marriage as one man, one woman. Happily, the Minnesota legislature did that just a few months ago.
How do you reach out to kids who are dealing with bullying that it really is at a different level?
It's at a different level now, particularly for gay and lesbian teenagers. We've been subjected for the last 15 years to an anti-gay hate campaign, demagoguery, lies, distortions, really a brutal, dehumanizing campaign, the religious right claiming that gays and lesbians are out to destroy the institution of marriage, destroy the family, destroy the military.
We have to understand, barbarians need to be educated. They need to be disciplined.
It's a very sad life. It's part of Satan, I think, to say that this is gay. It's anything but gay.
This is Shane, and he says gay people are disgusting. Greg says that he is terrified of gay people. Mark says that he feels like homosexuality is a shameful disorder. All three of these men are gay.
Andrew Ramirez of Minneapolis was 17 when his family sent him to Bachmann and Associates, where he says a counselor working for Bachmann tried unsuccessfully to save him from his sin.
God would forgive me if I was straight.
You can't pray away the gay, but you can torture a conflicted closet case to death.
Following 7 student suicides in fewer than 2 years.
Billy Lucas of Greensburg, Indiana, was just 15 years old when bullying pushed him over the edge.
There's a lot of people that are bullied that never kill themselves. But the boy already hated himself because he was dealing with the demonic force of homosexuality.
Well, I was just wondering, were you born a bigot or did you grow into it?
Over 160,000 kids stay home from school every day for fear of being bullied.
And it goes back to our leaders, I think. That's what's teaching our younger generation, you know, what is right and what is wrong.
Where are our heroes? You be that hero. We have to intervene.
John, I support a constitutional amendment to define marriage as between a man and a woman.
I believe that Don't Ask, Don't Tell should have been kept in place.
It is dangerous. It's disrupting your morale.
Because if you're involved in the gay and lesbian lifestyle, it's bondage.
Sorry, but I did want to remind you of the stakes of what we're talking about. It's poetry and it's death. I mean, it's a cultural phenomenon, this Calvinism that says, you know, nature is evil, people innately are evil, you know, we have to fight against it. That has a lot of traction in my state, and that video is about people in my state. It's very personal to me. Michelle Bachmann's lesbian sister is a close friend of mine, and she's been in a very loving relationship for 20 years, and it's not that you just need to meet someone who's gay to get over this. If you believe, if that is instilled in you, that this is satanic, it's going to be really hard to just think, you know, oh, well, I guess I was wrong about that. And so these beliefs are very deep. And that's the first one, that the body, and I think really, you know, gay sex, which is the, you know, the nightmare here, is a metaphor for how imperfect and messy and out of control just nature and the body really is. So faith can be seen as against the body. It can be seen as located completely in the body. You know, right here, right now, no tension. Again, I think a significant part of Unitarian Universalism is located there, and I think that's a really good thing, that body and soul are one. They're not separable. The only trick about this one, that faith is right there in the body, is that it's not just my body. It's every body. It's those people we just saw on the screen, them too. If we're going to believe that everything that's holy is right here in us, we're going to believe it about every single person on the planet. And that's not a small thing to believe. The minute I start saying to myself, you're not an ex-gay, you're a closet case, I'm deciding that I know more than they do about their own body experience. I'm no longer in that belief system. So it's not an easy one. I just want to say that. Can also be seen as over the body, and that's kind of what we heard. Poor Marcus Bachmann, who appears from all evidence to be struggling with his own demons, you know, he's saying, you've got to discipline it, you've got to tame it. It's like, what is it in himself? But he's saying, you stay up here, you stay in the control, and that's where the faith is. And that's, you know, that can spur fasting or other things, you know, healthy and self-destructive things for people. We can understand faith and the body as just in perpetual tension with each other. You know, I don't know about you, but when I listened some years ago, and this will date me, but to Monica Lewinsky describing, and I did it just like you'd watch a train wreck, describing, you know, a full page in the Washington Post, what she and Bill Clinton were up to, I just wished he'd enjoyed it more. You know, it was so sad for him to go through all that and to seemingly not really be able to just enjoy what he was doing. And sometimes that kind of tension can be erotic in its own kind of way, I guess, of saying this is bad, this is wrong, I'm doing it anyway. But that kind of tension. I have a friend who used to be a nun who was one of many nuns who came out and left the convent together, and she said there was an erotic tension in processing endlessly about celibacy and God, and you know, so you know, everybody's got their own ways. I'm not to judge, but it's that tension, that eternal tension. And the final way that I think holds some real merit for us to think about is that the body and faith can inform and transform each other. Now, somebody asked me yesterday afternoon, "Would you just define faith?" Because you're throwing that word around. And I said, I'm not really good with definitions exactly, but what I'm talking about is how we live out our deepest values, what we hold to and how we live that. I don't think of faith as what we believe. It's not a mental thing to me. It's all about our lives. I think that's our faith. That it's about deeds, not creeds. So I'm really proud that with the United Church of Christ, the UUA for years has been sponsoring our whole lives, a comprehensive sex ed class that really, for people who are in junior high, can transform their sense from the cultures of what sexuality is. I grew up in the How Miracles Abound curriculum, which was very much about watching, you know, chickens lay eggs and eggs in the incubator and snakes shed their skin, but it never occurred to any of us that it had anything to do with what was called sex. You know, I remember my sister read a James Bond novel, and James Bond said to this, you know, young, beautiful woman, you want to go make babies? And she said to me, oh my God, I just figured something out. Like, everything that we're talking about at church is about this other thing called sex. And we just had never put them together. So I'm really glad that this curriculum is making all of that explicit for young people. And all the people who know anything about it say that it's the best curriculum, and I think we're all proud of that, and the fact that our kids go through that, like confirmation, kind of says that. So wherever we locate faith with relationship to the body, it will profoundly affect how we live. George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist who I've followed for years. He lifts up how we use metaphors to create meaning. And way back in 1980, he wrote a book called Metaphors We Live By. And he said, metaphor is viewed typically as characteristic of language alone, a matter of words rather than thought or action. We have found, on the contrary, that metaphor is pervasive in everyday life, not just in language, but in thought and action. Our ordinary conceptual system, in terms of which we both think and act, is fundamentally metaphorical in nature. The concepts that govern our thought are not just matters of the intellect, they also govern our everyday functioning down to the most mundane details. Now, why am I talking about metaphor when I'm talking about the body? Because in a way, when we're embodied we see the impermanence of being in a body, we start to see all of constructed reality, in a way, I think, as an attempt to get language that's always inadequate, that's always, you know, going down the river trying to hold something that's always shifting. There was a study a few years ago, some Stanford linguists took contemporary issues and they gave focus groups two different stories about a city that was ravaged by crime. And in one of the studies, they described crime as a beast that was ravaging the city. And in the other one, they described crime as a virus that was ravaging the city. And in the group that was talking about crime as a beast, all of the ideas that people came up to address crime were about containing and hurting and stopping that beast. They were about stiffer jail sentences and more police and more of this. Where when crime was described as a virus, people talked about how to heal it. That metaphor was more profound in how people approached crime than party affiliation, age, gender, anything else. The metaphor shaped how people thought that we needed to move forward. And so I think that the metaphors that we use for our own bodies and the metaphors that we use to understand the world have profound implications when we're addressing things like we just saw in the video. So as I talk about embodied theology today, I found myself turning over and over to poetry. Partly I think that's because I love poetry. And when we do on worship online, we can't use much of it because of copyright, so I'm kind of excited to get to use a lot of it. And partly my friend Kate Tucker said this. She said, a poem is an incarnation. A poem gives body to something, a ripple of consciousness, an experience of being human that can't be said any other way. Once the poet has done that labor of creation and the poem takes on a body, it always exists. It lives for eternity. Tucker says that love also is just an amorphous cloud, airy potential, until we labor and live in it in all those daily particular ways, noticing each other's faces and putting care into our action. Then we are like poets. We are giving body to our love by our living, the only body that love can hope to have. Ann Tucker says, love longs for a body, because once it has a body, it always exists. When Gia was 5 and we lived in Washington, D.C., and the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon had been attacked, I was heading out night after night to go lead worship services around the D.C. area, and as I was leaving yet again one night, she got very upset and said, I want you to stay home. And I said, well, sweetie, I'll be here in your heart. And she said, but my heart can't smell you or hold your hand. That wise teacher knew right then, the flesh is more valuable than gold. The primary lesson of our bodies, as I bet you experienced yesterday when you talked about what's gone on in the last 15 years, is impermanence and continual change and evolution. I remember when Gia was just a toddler, one day I saw her kind of scampering off across a field. I was watching her back, and I thought to myself, it just came into my cells. I thought, this is really it. This is what parenting is. It's watching your kid go. That's what it is. She's just a toddler. You think about, we use the metaphor of having a baby or raising a child, but the truth is you have a baby for a very short amount of time, and then you have this being who's got their own life, who's on their own way. This is the essence of it. So I wrote this poem about that experience. I'd been asked to write a blessing to include in a book welcoming the new millennium. And for those of you who don't have kids or don't relate really to the kid as a metaphor here, I really think of children as people's hearts walking around in their own bodies. So think about something that your heart's walking around in. It may be your work, it may be poetry that you create, some kind of creation, but something you've incarnated into body, either physically or, in my case, I adopted my child. I didn't bring her out of my body, but really my love, I feel like, has created a lot of who she is. Well, a little bit. So this is the poem I wrote. New millennium, rushing river of days, cradle every parent's child in your waters. We launch our babes in fragile baskets. Moses multiplied by millions, released from muddy shores through no generosity or fearlessness of ours, despite our instincts. We squint to see around your bends as our own hearts are carried away. We throw small sticks to float behind the baskets, our prayers. My child loves her body. She finds shameless joy in each of her parts. Sorry, I kicked water over and I was afraid it was opening. I'm going to start that over. My child loves her body. She finds shameless joy in each of her parts, which she knows by touch, by name, elbow, eyebrow. Nothing escapes her interest. She has an endless stream of kisses for the cut on her own foot. May love of flesh, of body, be honored in your days. Despite clumsy toddlerhood, my daughter has tender love for the world. I see it in her careful attempt to reattach a leaf to a branch. She wants to drink rainwater from puddles. She roars at thunder. She pats our faces or the cat's, chanting under her breath, pat, pat, pat. May tender care for life be honored in your days. My daughter's favorite word is no, but no and yes alike are uttered with joy, a song, or with defiance, an occasional kick. She expects to be listened to. She screams when we force medicine or when her other wishes are overruled by our larger bodies. May the desires of the small and vulnerable be honored in your days. My daughter sees her own beauty in the mirror of every moment. She has no idea yet that someone else's funhouse could distort her. May she ever see reflected back to her the beauty of female power, Asian eyes, short, stocky legs, a family with two moms. May the beauty of life's diversity be honored in your days. New millennium, rushing river of days, I acknowledge your inevitable claim on this, the most sacred gift ever entrusted to me. All over the globe, mothers, fathers, other adults do the same, each surrendering to your currents. Please cradle each child gently and deeply in your days. May we cradle each other gently and deeply in our days. It's so fun to remember that now that she's a sullen teenager. she's a wonderful person, but I'll have to show her this poem. I was going to read you another poem. This is called No Longer a Teenager by Gerald Loughlin. My daughter, who turns 20 tomorrow, has become truly independent. She doesn't need her father to help her deal with the bureaucracies of schools, HMOs, insurance, the DMV. She is quite capable of handling landlords, bosses, and auto repair shops. Also boyfriends and roommates, and her mother. Frankly, it's been a big relief. The teenage years were often stressful. Sometimes, though, I feel a little useless. But when she drove down from Northern California to visit us for a couple of days, she came through the door with the biggest, warmest hug in the world for me. And when we all went out for lunch, she said, affecting a little girl voice, "I'm going to sit next to my daddy." And she did, and slid over close to me so I could put my arm around her shoulder until the food arrived. I've been keeping busy since she's been gone, mainly with my teaching and writing, a little travel connected with both. But I realize now how long it had been since I had felt deep emotion. When she left, I said simply, "I love you." And she replied quietly, "I love you too." You know, it isn't always easy for a 20-year-old to say that. It isn't always easy for a father. Literature and opera are full of characters who die for love. I stay alive for her. So recently, just this year, I had a cellular experience that reminded me of the one I had when Gia was a toddler, when I realized that she would be forever leaving and I would be forever blessing her and letting her go. Only this time it was regarding my own mortality. Since my father, my second parent, died, my mortality has felt a lot more present in my conscious mind. It's as if there was always an umbrella over me, protecting me in ways I didn't even know about until it was gone. And suddenly the rain was coming right onto my face. There are huge blessings in this, but also a stark truth. My own days and months and moments are running from me as surely as that toddler ran across the grass. That's the motion of life. That's the river. So whether I play endless games of solitaire on my iPhone, or cook a great dinner and invite friends over to share it, or fight with my kid, or dig in the garden, or try to create justice in the world, that moment is down the river. It's over, and it's not coming back. I think that cellular knowledge, I thought, oh, this is where midlife crises come from. I get it. What it does is it makes you just have a lot more scrutiny about what you're doing with your time. And to say, is this really it? And do I really want to be taking care of these belongings? No. Overboard. You know? Like, you just start going, what? That relationship always wears me out. You know, it's a good time. It's always a good time to realize what we're carrying that is not life-giving and to let it go. We also use poetry to carry us when that river of time feels like it's too much, when we feel like we're drowning in it, it's just going too fast. You know, the word metaphor comes from to carry over. So poetry can carry us over what maybe we can't carry ourselves over. Poetry, metaphor, often can be kind of a bridge to something we can't quite verbalize yet. And so I think language, finding deep language that's grounded in our body, is a huge gift of our faith. I don't know about you, but sometimes when I'm using Google search engines to find a poem that I know, which Helen Atwin at Beacon Press hates that. She just gets furious that people do that, because it's true. You start accrediting things to the wrong authors and all kinds of stuff. But sure is quick, isn't it? But Mary Oliver was at GA a few years ago, and she came up to my friend John Hurley, and she said, "I've been trying to figure out, you know, where this line of poetry came from, and someone told me you might know." And so she said this line of poetry. And he said, "Oh, I don't know, but I'll find out." And so he went, of course, put it in a search engine, came back 5 minutes later and said, "It's from whatever it was from." And she said, "How did you do that?" He said, "Well, I used a search engine." Mary Oliver said, "I don't use computers at all." She, you know, here's one of my favorite poets who's just like, nope, not going to do that. So anyway, I thought that was astounding, really. But often when you Google poetry, what you get is sermons in Unitarian Universalist churches. It happens to me all the time. I'll be looking for some obscure poem, and it's either Garrison Keillor's website, which is a great one about poetry, which I go to all the time, and you can watch videos of poets there, or it's a Unitarian Universalist church, where we are taking the living span, the metaphor that comes from the living body. We're the ones often who are using that. Some United Church of Christ churches use that as well as scripture. But, you know, a lot of my preacher friends who are in traditional churches, Christian churches, they get their two pieces of scripture, and that's pretty much it for the reading. You know, my cousin Marguerite is a Presbyterian minister, and she sends, every time she's preaching, she sends her sermons out for a bunch of us to give her feedback on, which I love. She writes them on Monday. I can't quite relate to that, but she writes them really early, and then she gets feedback, and she sends out a new draft on Thursday. I'm awed by this fact, but I've never seen her use another piece of poetry besides the two pieces of scripture, which are sometimes fabulous poetry and sometimes, in my opinion, meaningless, you know, gibberish. But she can never say that. But I wanted to share Liesl Mueller's book, poem called When I Am Asked. This is about how she became a poet. When I am asked how I began writing poems, I talk about the indifference of nature. It was soon after my mother died, a brilliant June day, everything blooming. I sat on a gray stone bench in a lovingly planted garden, but the day lilies were as deaf as the ears of drunken sleepers, and the roses curved inward. Nothing was black or broken, and not a leaf fell. And the sun blared endless commercials for summer holidays. I sat on a gray stone bench, ringed with the ingenue faces of pink and white impatience, and placed my grief in the mouth of language, the only thing that would grieve with me. She's not denying nature or the experience of her body, but she's looking for a way to channel the meaning, too. She's launching her grief into the world like a child running across a meadow. She's trying to keep up with it. Impermanence is the daily lesson of the body. Finding metaphor is a way to seek immortality, to seek an incarnation that can take root. Whether or not we're poets, the understanding that we're here temporarily can lead us to greatly enhanced awareness and joy of the blessings of life, or it can lead us to fear and judge and resist. It can tell you right now, sitting in your chair, where my voice goes on and on, here I am, or you can be sitting there saying, oh no, don't want to be here, I'd rather be somewhere else. So this inspires me to take a moment to breathe, which is always a good idea, and to allow you to do the same, which you've probably been doing, or you might be dead by now. I'm going to ask Cliff to put on a video of a singer named Nomalee Brennett, her song Stars, which is just full of metaphors about maybe what we're doing here on this planet.
Galaxies hurtling on towards some unrevealed destiny. Maybe we're somebody's unfinished symphony. Maybe we're the defenders of the indefensible, just trying to make some sense of the incomprehensible. And what if we are? What if we are stars? Maybe we're the victims of reincarnation, and maybe we're the phantoms of manifestation, and maybe we're just here to fix our mistakes again. Maybe we're planets like Venus and Saturn, surrounded by gases and protons and atoms. And what if we are? What if we are only? Thinner than it seems. Maybe we're all partners in the same lucid dream. Yeah, maybe we're vapors. Maybe we're just steam. Maybe we're creatures of habit and malice, and pale in the light of aurora borealis. And what if we are? What if we are only?
Anomaly made up her own name from the word anomaly. She's a transgender singer, male to female. And when you see all of that hate that we saw earlier directed out, and you imagine that she could have taken that as the only mirror to look into and never seen this blessing that she now offers the world through her music, see some of my passion for sharing our knowledge about how precious we are with the world. I know that today might seem a far stretch from social media, but what I'm trying to say is why it's so important to me that we share who we are with the world. Because I think we can save people. I really do believe that. Yeah. Thank you. When we're embodied, it's where we learn empathy, it's where we learn humanity, it's where we learn that we're connected. Everybody's just walking around like us, these vulnerable bags of bones, whatever they might be trying to cling to. We're born vulnerable and we die vulnerable. And so when we're embodied, it, I think, builds our commitment to the planet, to those beings that we know and those we shall never live to see. William Stafford wrote, "If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star." Sure. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. Social media for me is one more way to help fewer people miss our star. Darn it, it's such a beautiful star, isn't it? As I said yesterday, I don't think we're the only star in the solar system, and sometimes we get into, if we're not unique, we have nothing to offer the world. Why? Why can't we just be, in Minnesota, there's kind of a good enough mentality. We're a good enough faith. We're good enough to offer ourselves to the world. For those of us who went to General Assembly this summer, are people in the room who were there? A few, yeah. It was standing outside Tent City in that heat that brought it home to our bodies. How inhuman, we already knew it in our heads, but our bodies learned how inhuman that people guilty of nothing more than traffic violations, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and being Latino, are spending years in 130-degree heat in these tents that Joe Arpaio himself has called concentration camps. Once our bodies hold that knowledge, they don't forget. I hope, I pray, they don't forget. That's the point of being there. Once our bodies hold our love for someone who's suffering, great compassion can arise. So, though we're not the only ones who live here, I think it's so important that we claim our place and move forward. I would never want Unitarian Universalism to become an identity that we glue ourselves to as if it's the ultimate identity. I think our ultimate identity is earthling. We're all earthlings here, and that's not an abstract identity. If you think it's abstract, hold your breath and see how long you live. We're all connected here. All of us are so connected here, and so I believe that this poetry that we bring to this world, the knowledge that we come from the stars and that each of us is blessed, is a great gift. And tomorrow I'm going to start talking about new ways that I think that this new media allows us to offer that. Today I'll close with one more poem. Even though it's called Summer in San Francisco, it made me think of being here. Called A Warm Summer in San Francisco. It's by Carolyn Miller. Although I watched and waited for it every day, somehow I missed it, the moment when everything reached the peak of ripeness. It wasn't at the solstice, that was only the time of the longest light. It was sometime after that, when the plants had absorbed all that sun, had taken it into themselves for food and swelled to the height of fullness. It was in July, in a dizzy blaze of heat and fog, when on some nights it was too hot to sleep. One day the garden was almost overwhelmed with fruition. My sweet peas struggled out of the raised bed onto the mulch of laurel leaves and bark and pods. Their brilliantly colored sunbonnets of rose and stippled pink, magenta, and deep purple pouring out a perfume that was almost oriental. At the market, surrounded by black plums and rosy plums and sugar prunes and white-fleshed peaches and nectarines, I felt tears come into my eyes absurdly because I knew that summer had peaked and was already passing away. I felt very close then to understanding the mystery. It seemed to me that I almost knew what it meant to be alive, as if my life had swelled to some high moment of response, as if I could reach out and touch the season, as if I were inside its body, surrounded by sweet pulp and juice, shimmering veins, and ripened skin. See you tomorrow.
My toes.